This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Ordered back to their cells. Inmates and guards began to argue until the staff responded by threatening the inmates with stun guns, and the inmates returned to their cells. Jail staff later used pepper spray to move some inmates to isolated cells. The disruption caused a delay in accepting new arrestees at the jail for 3 hours. It also delayed proceedings at the Marion County Courthouse because inmates could not be transported to court appearances.
A group of Portland activists has begun holding weekly vigils at Pioneer Courthouse Square to raise awareness of the U.S. military's drone policy. Trudy Cooper, one of the organizers, says that she was inspired to start the protest after visiting Pakistan with a Code Pink delegation several months ago.
I went with Code Pink to Waziristan several months ago, and the purpose was to talk to the families of the survivors and to be able to bring back some genuine information, because the actual statistics of civilian casualties are not, they may be recorded by this government, but they are not public. The drone strikes occur in Yemen, Somalia, and Pakistan primarily, and most of them have occurred in Pakistan, and the casualties have been really high. The civilian casualties have been really high. Only 2% of the people killed are high-value targets, in other words, Al-Qaeda.
So that 2% figure contradicts what the U.S. government claims, which is that most of those killed by drone strikes are the targets. Where are the numbers that you're getting coming from?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. It's the Bureau of Investigative Journalism has a pretty complex methodology for getting right down on the ground and finding out who has been struck. And there are also journalists who are from Waziristan who have recorded and photographed the civilian deaths. So it's several sources have been brought together by Columbia University. It's pretty well established that, you know, they are reputable figures. And the figures are that there have been 350 drone strikes in Pakistan alone and nearly 1,000 civilians killed between the various countries.
The protesters have been gathering. Despite its reputation, the protesters have been gathering every Friday at noon in Pioneer Courthouse Square. Today, the protesters were told by private security guards at the square that they could not pass out literature that includes websites of the nonprofit peace group Code Pink because the website has a donate link. According to the security guard, that constitutes soliciting donations, which is not allowed on Pioneer Courthouse Square property.
Last week, he was upset because one of our people had gotten in a interaction with someone in the square, and this week I think he was still concerned, and so he came up with kind of a technicality, and he said that because there were websites listed on our literature, and that if you went to the website and you opened it up, it would say somewhere on the website, it would say, please donate, you know, for a nonprofit organization like Code Pink. And so he said that that meant that we were soliciting money. We were trying to have a financial transaction with people in the square, was what he said.
Despite its reputation as Portland's living room, Pioneer Courthouse Square is privately owned and operated and is not subject to free speech laws that apply to public property.
The Oregon State Legislature is considering legislation that would allow hunting of cougars with dogs. Several local groups, including the Oregon Cougar Action Team, are organizing a protest next Wednesday at the state capitol to oppose the bill. For more, KBOO's Sean Stewart spoke with one of the organizers of the rally.
Can you remind us again when the rally is?
The rally is going to be on May 8th. From noon to 1:30, that's next Wednesday, I believe, on the front steps of the Capitol building in Salem, Oregon. We're going to have the rally from noon until 1:30, and we have all the posters, all the signs. We just need you there to stand up for Measure 18, to stand up for our cougar, to stand up for better policymaking, more humane policies, and better a more humane cougar management plan.
Okay. Who allows or regulates the hounds to kill the cougars?
Well, currently right now, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife under House Bill 2390 is supposedly has a program of regulating them, although it's not been made very public. They're supposed to do a criminal background check, make sure there's not been any animal abuse or anything like that before they allow someone to go out on their behalf to hunt cougar with hounds. Whereas if we open up the county with House Bill 2624, we don't have those criminal checks or the animal abuse checks. We just open it wide open for a lot of animal abuse and a lot of poaching.
So you had mentioned those two House bills. I was curious, why has there been three House bills and one Senate bill allowing the cougar hunt?
Well, that's tradition. I almost call it tradition because every legislative session, ODFW does everything they can to chip away at the foundation of Measure 18. So they keep throwing one cougar bill out there after another. And just when we succeed at dealing with one cougar bill, another one literally pops up out of the woodwork. And I can't quite figure out how it's even lawful under the statutory rules and regulations of conduct at state legislature to have so many of these cougar bills keep resurfacing when we actually have much more important issues to take care of.
How long have these regulations been in effect?
2390, I believe, has been in effect since 2009. 2624 would be new. Measure 18 has been for almost 20 years, and we are actually killing more cougar now than we were before Measure 18 because of ODFW changing their internal policies, looking the other way with poaching issues, not following through with the by law. They were supposed to do a peer review every 5 years. They did not. They have just truly dropped the ball on the science as well, because one of the peer reviews that did happen to get done back, I think, in 2008, stated that ODFW needed to go back to the drawing board because their cougar management plan and their model population count was not based on science, couldn't even be published in a scientific review journal.
As far as Measure 18 is concerned, how many votes are needed for that to pass?
Well, all the state of Oregon voted twice. That means people in rural Oregon, as well as the cities, they all collectively voted. And I don't remember what it was, but it was they passed it twice without question, without a doubt.
And what is the next step after Measure 18 passes?
Well, ODFW should have followed through with the state law of doing a peer review every 5 years. They did not. They needed to have an accurate cougar model population account. It is not. Never has been. It was an arbitrary number that they picked out of the air. They should have stood behind Measure 18 and developed programs that would coexist, allow cougar to coexist with human habitat, livestock, and wildlife management. Instead, they've exacerbated the population problems out there with the deer and the elk because they've overhunted the cougar, which also creates safety factors for humans, because then you have these orphan cougar cubs, if they survive the hunt, wander in to human populations starving to death, or you have, which is like clockwork around every state legislature, what is called domesticated cougars. Cougar cubs are one of the few wildlife that, if taken young enough from the wild, can be domesticated. And these cats then can be raised in captivity until right around state legislature time, and all of a sudden, these very elusive, hard-to-find cougar that you need to have hounds to kill suddenly start showing up at school playgrounds. Because I believe, it appears to me, that domesticated cougar was released in that area with the intent of exploiting it to try to get these bills passed, to try to make people believe we have a cougar population explosion.
This is Sean Stewart with KBOO News.
As reported earlier on KBOO News, several local nonprofits received $20,000 grants from the Healthy Kids Political Action Committee to campaign for the fluoride ballot initiative. the local nonprofits that took the grants and are not registered as PACs or political action committees are on questionable legal ground. For more, KBOO's Joe Meyer spoke with Matt Morton, executive director of NEA, and Dan Meek, attorney and campaign finance reform activist.
The political action committee Healthy Kids, Healthy Portland touts dozens of local nonprofits that support fluoridation of Portland's water. This support was tarnished when it was revealed that many of the local groups received cash donations from the Healthy Kids PAC. I asked executive director of the Native American Youth and Family Services, Matt Morton, about the $20,000 his group received.
We received a capacity building grant to activate our voting public and inform them, really for the first time that I know of, that communities of color have been specifically sought out to help support something like this. And in doing so, the campaign, frankly, did exactly what they should have. They went to culturally specific community-based organizations that serve these communities and say, what is the best way to reach out to these communities?
Can you say about how much money you got from Healthy Kids, Healthy Portland?
Yeah, $20,000.
What do you think the source of that money is?
Well, the source is from their funders, their donors to their campaign.
Would you be surprised if that were the fertilizer company?
Are you suggesting that the fertilizer company is paying us to do work on this campaign?
That was Matt Morton, executive director of NEA. For a legal look at the flow of cash, I spoke with local attorney and campaign finance activist Dan Meek.
Expenditures have to be reported, and they're supposed to be reported under the rules of the Secretary of State in some detail. What the Healthy Kids campaign, the pro-fluoridation campaign, has been doing is paying agents. That is, they've been making payments to a variety of organizations whose purpose is not doing political campaigns, by the way. They're nonprofit organizations like community development organizations, and has been making to them lump sum payments and simply categorizing those payments on their campaign reports as outreach. For example, many candidates will hire a consultant, and of course the Yes on Fluoride campaign has hired a very well-known campaign consultant, a winning mark firm, and candidate will simply report on their what's called their C&E form, their contribution and expenditure form, an expenditure of $50,000 or $100,000 to the winning mark firm, without specifying what that money is being spent on. So it seems to be the same sort of situation as here, that where the campaign is making payments on the order of $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, apparently, to organizations, and then just saying it's for outreach. Of course, when a campaign hires a consultant, the campaign will have a contract with the consultant specifying what the consultant is supposed to do. In the case of these payments to community organizations, the Yes on Fluoride campaign, she said, oh, yes, we have contracts, but they refused to provide a copy of any of them. So whether they have contracts or not sort of remains up in the air. And if they don't have contracts and they're just making these very large lump sum payments and just saying it's for outreach, then another statute potentially comes into play. And that is ORS 260.665, which is called the Undue Influence Statute. It's basically Oregon's anti-bribery statute. Never uses the term bribery, but that's what it is. So if a campaign is just handing out large wads of cash with no strings attached, it might be hard to distinguish from what this statute calls undue influence, which is a felony in Oregon.
That was attorney and campaign finance activist Dan Meek. He explained that if local nonprofits received money to campaign for a ballot measure, then they need to register as a PAC. If they receive this as a cash gift, then they may be in violation of undue influence legislation. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
The Service Employees International Union, SEIU Local 503, held a rally outside the Bank of America in downtown Portland today. They call on Governor Kitzhaber to sue this and other banks for their role in the LIBOR scandal. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Heather Conroy of the SEIU local.
I wonder if you could talk about your group's action in downtown Portland earlier today.
Yeah, today we were joined by community allies like the Working Families Party and other unions, including the Oregon AFL-CIO, to call on the governor to stand up to sue the banks who have been involved in LIBOR fraud. And this is a manipulation of interest rates that have caused Oregon's investments to underperform. We recently discovered that the state of Oregon has lost upwards of $110 million to this LIBOR fraud alone.
So how does this work? The interest rates are somehow manipulated by the banks?
That's exactly right. So the banks, including three banks that operate here in Oregon, report interest rates, which is then used to calculate many, many different ways that financial institutions do their business, including it impacts the investment rates, the return on investment rates for things like the Public Employee Retirement Fund as well as other public funds. And so what's happened is they have suppressed the interest rates, so we have not gotten the kind of returns that we should have. This has impacted everyday people's investments, too. This is about the way the financial industry has really manipulated the markets. It's different than the derivatives that we've seen in the past.
This lawsuit that you're proposing, is it something that there is a precedent for, or would Oregon be the first state to sue these banks?
So in Oregon, our treasurer, Ted Wheeler, and our attorney general, Ellen Rosenblum, do have a track record of suing banks over issues of fraud and other illegal activities. Yet no one yet has taken on the LIBOR fraud, even though we've had three banks actually admit and reach settlements in other venues. So we are calling on the governor to use his voice to really push to say now is the time for Oregon to get our money back. We are having conversations in the state about all the ways in which to balance the budget that really come from taking from retirees, taking from kids in their classrooms, yet we're not hearing our elected leaders talking about going after the money that was illegally taken by the banks. Every day that we don't take action, a statute of limitations is ticking, and so we're losing near $3 million a month by taking no action.
What does that mean? How is it that the state is losing money by not taking action?
Because the fraud was committed between 2007 and 2010. So during that time, we have calculated it's $110 million of Oregon investments that were lost. But every month that they delay filing the lawsuit, $3 million drops off of what's recoupable by the lawsuit. For instance, if the five-year mark hit in May, then everything that had happened in April and March is no longer recoverable.
And today there was a rally outside of certain banks?
Today we had an event outside of Bank America and Second and Morrison where we launched a website that has a public petition to have other groups join with us to call on the governor to sue the banks.
And if people are interested in finding out more or finding that petition online, where would they go?
They can go to our union's website at www.seiu503.org.
Great. Thank you so much. Again, I've been speaking with Heather Conroy, the executive director of the local branch of the Service Employees International Union. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. We'll speak with the International Center for Transitional Justice about Guatemala, Guantanamo, and the United States. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is clear with temperatures in the 80s through the weekend.
It's 5:23. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
You never know how popular you are, how smart you are, and how funny your jokes are until you become the head of a congressional committee. If you're named to chair a major legislative panel, suddenly people are eager to show you love, respect, and cash. well, not normal people, but corporate lobbyists who want legislative favors from the committee barons. These favor seekers know that the way to get cozy with powerhouse lawmakers is to show them the money. Sure enough, in January, 9 Republicans were elevated to the top position of their committees in the U.S. House. And in just the first 3 months of their reign, these newly crowned chairs have enjoyed an inflow of $1.3 million into their campaign accounts from political action committees. That's 74% more than the 9 attracted prior to their ascendancy to the throne. Perhaps you want to believe that the beneficence of the PACs merely reflects an altruistic commitment to good, honest, unbiased public policy. No, no, Nanette. The bulk of the lucre comes from the very industries that the recipients are supposed to oversee. Check out Bill Schuster, for example, top beneficiary of this year's increase in PAC largesse. His haul of over $300,000 since January is 5 times more than he collected from PACs last year, with big bundles being donated by airlines, cruise ships, railroads, and trucking outfits. Can you guess which committee Bill chairs? Yes, transportation. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, Schuster would tell you that by golly's money can't buy him. But the industries don't need to purchase the committee chairman. A short-term rental is all they need. That $300,000 is just the deposit on Schuster, for he'll be taking regular payments as he pushes their bills along. But it's still a great deal for lobbyists. Think about it. A timeshare in a member of Congress.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
On Wednesday, a lawsuit was filed against Correction Corporation of America for failure to release information related to deaths and health care in a Texas state prison. Prison Legal News, a monthly magazine focused on prisoner rights, is seeking to force CCA to comply with an open records request. Numerous criminal justice advocacy organizations have accused CCA of inadequate medical care and preventable deaths at the Dawson State Jail. Prison Legal News is filing the suit in order to, quote, enforce its right under state law to investigate patterns of unconscionable and unconstitutional conditions in corporate-run jails, end quote. The jail is one of 12 Texas state prison facilities run by the CCA and is among several facilities facing closure in the next budget session. The state Senate's version of the coming budget would remove funding from Dawson State Jail, while the House budget would not. A conference committee of lawmakers is currently debating the issue.
The group known as the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, began its Spring Summit Task Force last night in Oklahoma. The corporate-run group writes model legislation that is then submitted to state legislatures to become law. Despite pledges made earlier this year to be more transparent in its workings, the summit's agenda and goals have been kept secret, even from groups that filed Freedom of Information Act requests. For more, we go to KBOO's Robin Ryan.
The summit, which began yesterday in Oklahoma, was met by protesters organized through local labor unions and a coalition of organizations working in the public interest. Brendan Fisher with the Center for Media and Democracy spoke to me from the side of the protests.
I heard that they were expecting between 400 and 1,000 people, so that's really great. And I think people were coming from around the state and even from neighboring states. So it's really exciting to see people show up and raise their voice against ALEC and corporate control of politics.
Can you talk about the plan at the Oklahoma Community Forum?
The ALEC meeting is in full swing. Legislators will be attending the task force meetings where they'll be adopting model legislation. They'll be sitting side by side with corporate lobbyists, voting as equals to adopt model legislation that the legislators will then bring back to their state and introduce in their own name, and these are laws that are going to affect all of our lives, all of our respite, all of our rights, all of our responsibilities, and it's basically happening right now in closed-door meetings with corporate lobbyists and our elected officials. So in response to that, there is going to be a community forum organized where they're going to show the Bill Moyers documentary, United States of ALEC, and then there's going to be several speakers speaking about ALEC, including Nick Sergi from Center for Media and Democracy, Steve Spaulding from Common Cause, and Jane Carter from AFSCME. She's an economist at AFSCME.
Now, ALEC professed just a couple of months ago that they were going to adopt a whole new policy of transparency.
So ALEC has actually been around since 1973. For most of their 40-year history, they had kept all of the model bills secret. And in 2011, a whistleblower came to us with nearly 900 of these model bills. We published them on our website, alecexposed.org, and made the bills available for the general public and for journalists to identify what legislation introduced in their state has come from this ALEC model legislation. So earlier this year, ALEC voluntarily, quote-unquote, posted some of their model bills online, which they said was a move towards transparency. It was basically a meaningless move because the bills were already available. We had made them available. If they're calling this transparency, then they've done very little else to try and make their operations more available to the public. So the task force meetings where these bills are going to be adopted are still closed to the public. The press and public are both prohibited from those meetings. They've also taken great pains to protect their communications with legislators from open records requests. So in the past, we have been able to obtain the agendas and other information about these ALEC meetings through open records requests. This year, in the run-up to this meeting, we've gotten basically nothing. South Dakota, just last week, the Republican-led legislature decided that they're going to use taxpayer dollars to pay for ALEC membership for every single member of the legislature, both Republicans and Democrats, regardless of whether the individual legislator actually wants to be a part of ALEC.
That's the voice of Brendan Fisher with the Center for Media and Democracy. I also asked him which of ALEC's task forces caused him the most concern.
They're almost all equally terrible in different ways. I mean, the Education Task Force privatizes education. It uses taxpayer dollars. It changes laws to use taxpayer dollars to flow to the corporate members of that task force. The Tax and Fiscal Policy Task Force rewrites our tax laws to favor large corporations and wealthy individuals. The Energy and Environment Task Force preaches climate change denial, tries to repeal renewable energy standards, tries to undo low-carbon fuel standards. And then the Commerce, Insurance, and Economic Development Task Force fights against minimum wage, fights against prevailing wage standards, and, of course, promotes right-to-work and other anti-union bills. So they're all equally terrible, but just in their own ways.
A representative from Common Cause is on the team of panelists at today's forum. I spoke with Mary Boyle, the Vice President of Communications, about the whistleblower complaint her organization recently filed with the Internal Revenue Service. You filed a whistleblower suit with the IRS regarding the American Legislative Exchange Council.
They are an organization that tells the IRS that it does no lobbying. And we put together a few thousand pages of evidence showing that that is pretty much purely what they are about, to craft public policies that benefit the bottom line of their corporate members.
When do you expect to hear back from the IRS regarding your request?
We don't know, but it's my understanding that we will, that this is kind of not an optional thing, that because of the kind of complaint that was filed, that they are required to respond to us. So we don't know when, but we expect something.
The ALEC Summit is expected to continue through today. More information can be found on their website at alecexposed.org. For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
Rhode Island's governor signed legislation last night legalizing same-sex marriage. In a statement, Governor Lincoln Chafee said his signature means the state is, quote, at last upholding its legacy as a place founded on the principles of tolerance and diversity, end quote. Rhode Island is now the 10th state to advance marriage equality.
In related news, the Iowa Supreme Court ruled today that gay and lesbian couples have the same rights as heterosexual couples to be listed on a newborn's birth certificate. The state argued against this, saying it would create legal paternity confusion. But the justices said both members of straight couples are listed on birth certificates, even if the woman was artificially inseminated.
A new leak has been discovered in the ExxonMobil pipeline that ruptured last March, causing a massive oil spill in Arkansas. The rupture was discovered on Wednesday and leaked about 42 gallons of oil before being patched today. The spill that occurred last March leaked 5,000 barrels of oil into neighborhoods and waterways before the pipeline could be repaired.
A New York appeals court says local communities have the right to ban oil and gas development within their jurisdiction. In a ruling yesterday, the court upheld a decision allowing the small upstate New York towns of Dryden and Middlefield to ban fracking. Harvard Law School's Sean Goho says yesterday's ruling won't be binding in other states, but towns around the country are watching closely.
Municipalities have shown a new interest in passing such ordinances, and this interest is being driven primarily by the rise of shale gas and shale oil, and fracking is bringing gas drilling into places that haven't had to deal with it before.
A lawyer for Norse Energy, the Norwegian company who appealed, said they're looking into taking the case to a higher court.
6 months after Hurricane Sandy hit the New York and New Jersey coast, the governor of New Jersey announced the first distribution of federal grant money. Some residents complained that it has taken far too long for needed funding to reach them, and homes with mold have become unlivable in the 6 months that have elapsed without aid. Governor Christie told reporters that nearly $2 billion of the $37 billion given to New Jersey will now be available for homeowners and small businesses to apply for grants of up to $150,000. The money would be paid directly to contractors doing reconstruction work and not to the homeowners themselves. In New York City, hundreds of hurricane victims were scheduled to be evicted from temporary housing today, but a court order has allowed a temporary reprieve until May 15th. The hurricane survivors filed a lawsuit against the city of New York, saying that they were not provided with the help necessary to find long-term affordable housing after Sandy. Some of the survivors in temporary housing were homeless at the time the storm hit and are about to be put out into the street again. Members of Occupy Sandy, a spin-off group from the Occupy Wall Street movement, rallied today in New York City to support the hurricane victims that are set to lose their temporary housing just 2 weeks from today.
The government of Zimbabwe